Из пиратов в хулиганы. Следственный комитет,
России смягчил обвинения в адрес активистов Greenpeace, которые пытались провести...
Обвинения сняли, но на свободу не выпустили.
Комитет переквалифицировал статью пиратства на более мягкую.
Возможный срок наказания снизился в два раза с 15
лет. Максимальных 15 лет тюрьмы задержанным грозит 7 лет заключения. Однако в Greenpeace и эти обвинения считают неправильными.
The investigative committee this week dropped controversial piracy charges against 30 activists who were aboard Greenpeace's Arctic Sunrise ship, charging them instead with hooliganism. The move means the activists, who were detained in September protesting Gazprom's Arctic drilling, face 7 instead of 15 years in prison, and could be eligible for a broad amnesty scheduled for December. The climb down in the Greenpeace case is just the latest sign that the Kremlin may be softening the hard line against dissent it has pursued since Vladimir Putin returned to the Kremlin last year. Also this week, officials agreed to transfer Nadezhda Tolokonnikova of the feminist punk rock collective Pussy Riot to a new penitentiary after she went on a hunger strike to protest conditions at the prison colony in Mordovia where she had been jailed. And earlier this month, a court in Kirov suspended opposition leader Alexei Navalny's 5-year prison sentence on embezzlement charges widely seen as trumped up. Moreover, the Russian Constitutional Court overturned a law barring those convicted of serious crimes from running for office, potentially paving the way for Navalny to continue his political career. Moreover, some top officials, including Putin himself, have suggested that the defendants in the so-called Bolotnaya case against demonstrators who took to the streets and clashed with police in December 2012 could ultimately be amnestied. And all of this is taking place as the State Duma is ironing out the details of a broad amnesty scheduled to go into effect in December to mark the 20th anniversary of the Russian Constitution. Is the Kremlin softening its line? Is it just a tactical retreat? And whatever it is, what are the ends? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome back, Mark. We've missed you.
It's great to be here again.
It's great to have you. It's a two-man show today, so why don't we just get the ball rolling? I don't dare call it a thaw, and let's face it, it's not. And there's plenty of counterexamples. Bolotnaya defendant Mikhail Kasyanko, for example, was sent to a psychiatric clinic earlier this month, to name one. And Russia's Supreme Court this week upheld the life sentence of Alexei Pichugin, the imprisoned former head of security for the now-defunct Yukos Oil Company, defying a ruling by the European Court of Human Rights. But nevertheless, something, a tactical retreat on some fronts at the very least, appears to be happening. Mark, what are your thoughts on all this?
Okay, well, let me give you three possible rationales, and we can work out which one of those sounds more plausible. The first one is that these are just simply decisions that were being made upon the merits of the case. Some prosecutor decided that short of photoshopping parrots and eye patches on them, the Greenpeace crew didn't look like pirates, etc. Exactly.
I think we can safely
discount that one. So, the second and more plausible answer is that precisely this is, I'm not sure if I necessarily call it a tactic or let alone a strategy yet, but certainly an approach, which is precisely that you start with a very heavy-handed attempt to sort of basically ramp up the charges, ramp up the potential outcomes as a warning and as a threat and as a deterrent. And then you come along later and you soften it precisely to, first of all, make sure you don't have martyrs. Secondly, to emphasize that, in fact, look, this is the system working. This is actually the fact that we do have checks and balances, or that there is clemency that comes down from the Tsar or whatever. That it's, you know, an attempt to actually sort of almost build a slightly more nuanced form of authoritarianism. Now, clearly, what they would hope from that is that they get the best of both worlds. They get the intimidating quality of the initial case and then the legitimating element of showing mercy. of course, the risk is actually that it's precisely the other way round. They end up looking authoritarian and ham-fisted, but also weak and irresolute. So, I mean, I think that's probably something that's going on, and maybe reflects having sort of learnt some of the lessons from Pussy Riot. And it's interesting that precisely we're seeing some movement on Tolonikova's case. But the third way of looking at it, which isn't necessarily incompatible with the second, is that we should also think of this as part of the continuing struggle between specific interest groups within the regime and the Kremlin. It's the usual cynic dodge for Putin, the collective Putin, the deep state, call it what we want. Because the interesting thing is, in all of these cases, there have been specific elements with axes to grind. I mean, if we go back to Pussy Riot, I mean, clearly the Russian Orthodox Church was pushing hard. On Navalny and on Bolotnaya, we have Bastrykin, who's been interestingly and surprisingly quiet of late.
Yes, he has, hasn't he?
With Greenpeace, Gazprom was clearly lobbying for a very heavy sort of approach. So in one case, you know, we might say it's the usual case that actually if you're powerful within the state, you can have your enemies persecuted and thrown in prison. But in fact, then we have a case in which these are all cases in which the Kremlin has then subsequently come in and said, look, actually, your own interests are not the deciding factor. In all of these cases, there are actually potentially serious problems with going ahead with the vindictive agenda that you have initially forced on us, and therefore we're going to roll it back. So I think, you know, for all these reasons, I would say that therefore we have a mix of the two. We have option 2.5, which is that this is a strategy that reflects not just a changing sense of how to handle these cases, but also a changing sense of how much freedom to give institutional individual actors within the state.
Mm. So I see here, I mean, if we can dismiss the first option that everything is as it appears out of hand, I think we can pretty safely do that. We have, I guess, your second option I'd call the Pakhazuka option, right? This whole thing was a strategy from the start, and it's all an illusion almost. This was part of some grand plan, and this is all Pakhazuka, as they would say in Russian. The second is the elite struggle option, or the third, if you will, is the elite struggle option. I think that one sounds the most realistic to me. I think let's run with that for now, because there are perennial elite struggles. And does this shift that we're seeing now, if it is indeed a shift, does it signify some shift in the balance of power in the Kremlin? In the meta sense, are the Siloviki losing the argument to the technocrats for the time being on these cases, or does this signify anything broader or larger?
I certainly think it signifies something broader and larger, but just very briefly to touch on this point about Pakhazuka, I certainly don't think this was a sort of a carefully planned approach from the first. I think the natural instinct of the system is precisely when a powerful force within the elite wants someone nailed, then the system is there to nail them. And I think it's actually that we've done, in a way, we tend to see mid-course correction. We tend to see then people coming in saying, well, hang on a minute, you know, is it really worth trying to call these people pirates or not? So I don't think it's anyone right at the beginning said, I know what we're going to do. You know, we're going to sort of throw all these charges at them precisely so that we can then release them. Anyway, but going back to this business of balance of power within the elite, I do think that there is something significant here. I don't think it's a nice, neat Siloviks versus technocrats, because if nothing else, a lot of Siloviki are technocrats too. I think it is more a general point about the place of the Kremlin. And one of the things that has been so striking these past 2 years, really, has been how absent the Kremlin has been, the extent to which individuals and groups were able to basically wrench control of the agenda. Now we might be beginning, and I, you know, cautions with the might, underline it, highlight it, we might be beginning to see a slight return of the Kremlin in the sense of a less of a willingness to allow those individuals to have their way, more of a sense that, in fact, the needs of the system as a whole have to trump them. Because I think, you know, there's no way of getting around the fact that, you know, if you look at all these various cases, it's an astonishingly effective way of making sure you alienate as many people as possible. You know, going after Greenpeace, you know, not only does it clearly sort of not play well to environmental and other interests at home, but quite frankly, you know, I think the Kremlin has probably ruled those out as ardent supporters. But more to the point, internationally, you know, it had a considerable backlash. And Greenpeace is very good at mobilizing and articulating.
Yes, they
are. So it's a bad enemy to make, quite frankly. If one looks at, well, obviously, sort of the Navalny case, tremendously badly handled from start to finish, and has actually helped to both radicalize but also, you know, empower him. Bolotnaya likewise. A lot of the people swept up what people one would regard as kind of die-hard radicals, but it's pushed them into that position, and all their friends and families too. And Pussy Riot, they had no idea how much it would become a sort of cause célèbre internationally. You know, people who had never heard and would usually have had no time for this particular group, who regarded it as a sort of a benchmark, whatever. So I think for all these reasons, you know, one can look at case after case and actually realize that it's really been handled badly. And given that we do have an essentially irresolute Kremlin, one that seems not to have the courage either to reform, but nor to have the courage to be a thoroughly nasty authoritarian regime, it's about managing that middle line. And I think that there's a clear sense that they haven't managed it well. So I do think that in some ways, the absence of Bastrykin is in itself an interesting sort of symptom of this, that we are seeing, I think, the Kremlin trying to regain some control of the message. And whether this has anything to do with the sort of the slow sift back of your man Surkov, that's another question.
Yeah, no, that thought also crossed my mind. But when you say the Kremlin, do we mean Putin? We don't mean the collective Putin, because the collective Putin is comprised of all of these interest groups you're talking about. You're talking about the return of Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin as the decider, as the one that's going to decide Russia's next or not.
I think it's more broad than that. I mean, I don't think it's purely just Putin himself suddenly sort of clenching his fist and saying, now things are going to change. I think it actually reflects also a shifting of mood within the collective Putin.
Hmm.
You know, everyone wants to have their own personal way. Each of the individuals who make it up would like to have full freedom of maneuver. However, I think there is perhaps a slow dawning understanding that by leaning too much that way, leaning too much towards the autonomy of these groups and individual interests, they are undermining the security and the long-term stability of their state as a whole, their regime, let's say. So I think, again, as ever, Putin in this respect does not so much shape as reflect the consensus within the deep state. And there is that sense of, come on, actually, we've had our fun in those terms, but unfortunately now we do need to have more discipline. And Putin's role is precisely to be the applier of discipline as well as the decider. So, I mean, I think it is broader. And I think one can link it into a whole variety of other sort of micro cases that in and of themselves don't look significant. I mean, I was fascinated by the whole issue of Rogozhin and the gold, you know, metaphorically gold-plated pistols.
Mm-hmm.
This case that actually you have this bizarre situation in which Navalny and Rogozhin are actually talking the same kind of language at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
The extent to which there was this ridiculous plan to buy pistols for the defense ministry, Austrian-made pistols, for way, way over the asking price. They could, frankly, if they wanted guns, they could come and buy them from gun shows in the United States for less,
right.
You know, let alone the sort of bulk discounts. And you have him stepping in, Rogozhin now stepping in to stop and investigate that particular case. And again, what's clear is that was, you know, well, I say clear, what I assume is there's an element of sweetheart deals and individual interests at work there. And you now have the application of discipline. There's no real sense that the Kremlin is saying, oh, we have to have full transparency in all procurement decisions. It's more that the Kremlin, again, in this collective sense, is saying, for God's sake, some things are just stupid and undermine us all, and we need to do something about those cases.
Now, what about, and you've alluded to this a couple of times, your pal Bastrykin, our pal Bastrykin, he has kind of disappeared and in the process, like, deprived us of a lot of opportunities to write about him on our blog and talk about him on our podcast. But we're not going to let that stop us, because in his absence, he does give us a reason to talk about him. What's happened to Bastrykin? He used to be everywhere, and suddenly he's nowhere. And does that signify anything? Because it is striking how invisible he's become.
It is. And although it would be sort of tempting to think of him as being the sort of the spiked club being held behind the back, there don't seem to be even efforts to do that. I mean, I think, I'll be honest, I think there is a sense that Vastrykin overplayed his hand and has actually made the Kremlin more vulnerable rather than stronger, which is certainly, you know, what I've always been saying is the case with this sort of approach of his. And, I mean, this is going to have very serious political impacts for Vastrykin, the man who, after all, doesn't really have any kind of personal power base or clients and patrons within the Kremlin. Vastrykin was always like a shark in that he can't stop swimming. If he stops swimming, he drowns. Well, I think at the moment, Vastrykin has been artificially becalmed, precisely because he's regarded as something of a liability, which means that he's going to have to do one of two things. Either he's going to have to adapt and become much more of a smart predator, you know, and show that he can manage with more finesse, which has been distinctly lacking from his track record so far, or else, frankly, he's going to go. And let's face it, given that Vastrykin, you know, both in reality and in mythology, has become the sort of the focal point of the malign influences within the Kremlin, actually getting rid of him would in itself be an interesting gesture towards trying to rebuild some kind of relationship with society. So I can't help but feel that just as we've always speculated that sacking Medvedev as prime minister is one of those cards that's just being held in hand, you know, for when it might be useful, for when the value of playing the card outweighs the cost. Well, likewise, I can't help feeling that Vastrykin's future is another one of these cards. There's just a suitable moment. It may well be that they'll decide to play to try and make the sense of, no, look, actually we have a whole new social contract ready for the Russian people and it doesn't involve the likes of Vastrykin. So, I mean, I think that's the rather unfortunate situation he is in the moment.
But perhaps...
And of course we regret it.
Yes, we regret it deeply. How humiliating for him, or how much of a blow? I mean, because the Navalny thing had to be a serious blow. I mean, really, I mean, they had him locked up and shipped away. It was game over. And within 24 hours, he's out. Next thing you know, he's winning 28% of the vote in Moscow in the election. And then he gets his sentence suspended. Now the Supreme Court overturns the ban on him on those convicted of serious crimes, even with suspended sentences running for office. And at this point, the way this is moving, I don't exclude him being exonerated completely, because he is going to appeal this to the Supreme Court. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen, but I don't exclude the possibility. I don't dismiss it out of hand that this thing could just be overturned. How big a blow is this to Vastrykin? How can you withstand a blow like this in the law enforcement?
Well, I mean, you can withstand it for as long as the guy at the top chooses to keep you there. I mean, if we look at, for example, former Interior Minister Nurgaliyev, I mean, you know, that's a man who had to swallow humiliation after humiliation with the sure knowledge that most of his senior officers hated him. But the point is, because he was convenient for Putin, he stayed on for far, far longer than really he ought to have. So, you know, Vastrykin can stay as long as Putin regards it as more useful to have him there than thrown out. But two things. One is, I mean, the interesting thing about the Navalny case is that it shows that Putin, and again, you know, we use Putin to mean that sort of inner core leadership, but Putin still has the power. There is no question but that when Putin wants to reach out and change things, he can. The problem of the past couple of years has actually been Putin being, you know, internally unable, unwilling to act, really not knowing what to do, rather than that he just somehow was a prisoner of his elite. So, I mean, I think it's definitely shown that Putin is not a prisoner. But secondly, in terms of it certainly was, it has been and continues to be, a dramatic humiliation for Vastrykin. This was something that he really had built his case and his credibility with his Kremlin peers as being the guy who could get Navalny and in the process shatter the opposition. And we've seen that the opposition has not been shattered. I mean, it hasn't spread beyond a certain sort of base, but nonetheless, you know, it's if anything, consolidated within that base.
I would argue the opposite. I mean, it's energized the portion of the opposition that is actually dangerous to the Kremlin, this little network that Navalny's put together.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's dangerous. I mean, you know, all oppositions are dangerous. What I'm saying is that, you know, Navalny hasn't yet, so we'll see if the nationalism card works, stretched beyond his clear classic base. But he's absolutely very strong within that, and I agree, has been thoroughly energized by that. So, you know, Bastrykin has failed, and what's more, has been shown to have been reined in. Bastrykin, by political temperament as well as by sort of position, very much, you know, he built himself as a semi-autonomous attack dog, if I can mix my zoological metaphors. And I think as soon as you actually people notice that the attack dog is on a chain, then actually he becomes much less formidable and much less terrifying. So this is why, I think this is one of the interesting things, why he's been quiet. I mean, it might simply be that he's been told, oh, for God's sake, shut up and keep quiet. But I think it's also an element to which actually he himself is abstracting himself from public view, because beyond rather sort of pointless ceremonial visits, Bastrykin investigates the, you know, investigations committee offices in Vladivostok and whatever, and it gives people medals. You know, there's not really much he can do. I mean, even if we look at the Biryulyeva riots, yes, the investigations committee is involved in investigating that. That would have been a classic grandstanding moment.
Yes, it would.
A couple of months ago. And instead, we had Interior Minister Kolokoltsev doing the whole, I will silently gaze at this individual whom we have grabbed and claimed is the assailant. Ridiculous little piece of police theatre. But nonetheless, you know, they allowed the Interior Minister, who hitherto has very much been presented as effectively being the junior partner,
right,
to have the moment of glory, rather than Bastrykin. So I think for all of these reasons, it's clear that Bastrykin is both in current, at least, political decline, but also actually has been sequestered away.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but in the Volgograd bombing, which we'll be discussing in the second half of the program, he's not been exactly visible in that either, unless, have you seen some? I haven't seen much of him in that.
No, again, even his spokesman, Mark, I mean, hasn't been there. It's in, we've had some just, you know, very bland, standard issue press releases of the extent to which, you know, the investigations committee is looking into this, and, you know, we'll no doubt soon find who is to blame, etc. You know, this sort of thing, which frankly is just boilerplate. But no, I mean, exactly these kind of crisis situations, which, let's face it, if played correctly, as we can see from Defense Minister Shoigu's career, from when he was at the Emergencies Ministry, if played correctly, can actually be very sort of powerful podia to build your own credibility. They're precisely the ones that Bastrykin either is not, will not, or cannot take advantage of at the moment.
Well, let's the obvious next question now is, this isn't just about Bastrykin, and here's something I'd love to see you do a blog post on, but is the investigative committee on the decline now, because Bastrykin built up an empire and a monster there that was, remember, it was going to absorb all the law enforcement capacity of the country under its loving wing. Is this not just the decline of one man, but potentially the decline of an institution? And what does that mean?
Yes, it's interesting how at present all these plans to move pretty much all the investigative capacity of all the law enforcement agencies, the Interior Ministry, the Anti-Narcotic Service and so forth, into the Investigative Committee, they haven't been shelved or anything like that, but they just don't seem to be happening.
Yeah.
This is the classic model, actually, that you have sort of a disobedience just by not doing anything rather than by formally sort of complaining and protesting. Does this mean the decline of the investigative committee? Well, I would suggest that what it represents is the investigative committee being forced just simply to be what it was meant to be. Because in a way, there are two investigative committees. There is the body that was set up and actually made sense within the context of the Russian law enforcement structure to be the sort of streamlined, effective and professionalized agency which handled preliminary investigations and serious crime investigations. You know, it did make sense to separate that, given the sort of the investigative magistrate-driven model of Russian policing. We don't want to go into the granular detail there. But then there's the fact that under Bastrykin, the committee then became the vessel for precisely these not only empire-building instincts, but also these political policing instincts.
Right. They became the politics police.
Exactly, dissent police. And quite frankly, you know, that actually began to distort, and the great weight of that, the Investigative Commission's ability to actually do its proper job began to be degraded, because the best investigators were shifted to political investigations. Resources that, you know, aren't that massive all went to the political arm, leaving really, I hesitate to use the word dregs, but certainly relatively under-experienced investigators handling a lot of the proper crimes. So definitely, you know, the political police role distorted the whole thing. And I think what we might now see is, whether it's by design or default, the committee being pushed back into actually doing its proper job. And that, I think, actually, again, it doesn't mean that, firstly, that this couldn't change instantly if Putin, you know, wakes up tomorrow and decides, you know, comes to think of it, we need a chistka, you know, we need a purge. But secondly, there are other agencies that could just as easily step in. The Federal Security Service, the anti-extremism element of the Interior Ministry. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's face it, there are many political police in waiting.
Yeah, and you're totally anticipating me now, which is a good sign, because trust me, we didn't script this. At least not to this extent. So because right now, as we speak, it's October 25th, 2013, and it is today the 10th anniversary of the arrest of Mikhail Khodorkovsky. And at least since that time, at least since the arrest of Khodorkovsky 10 years ago, the politics police in some form has been a perennial staple of the Putin regime. And if we're seeing his politics police of the moment right now diminished, what do you see from somebody who looks at the Russian security services and law enforcement? What do you see as the most likely replacement for this? Because I don't think they're going to do without this tool in their toolbox.
The default is always going to be the Federal Security Service. Firstly, it's Putin's own service. It's the closest descendant of the KGB, that again is where Putin cut his teeth. It's pretty good at what it does. I'm not saying it's without flaws, and I'm certainly not, as it were, standing as to provide testament to its moral character. But, you know, if you want a political police service, the FSB is always there. Now, I think the reason why it has tended to, in recent times, to be eclipsed is firstly because, you know, Putin understands the spooks, and he's always leery of giving the FSB too much power. I mean, that's why every time the FSB has wanted to, in recent times, eat up other agencies to basically build itself as a KGB Mark II, he's actually not allowed it to do so, precisely so that he has checks and balances. But nonetheless, you know, I think that if push came to shove, the FSB is where he go to. And secondly, I mean, because the FSB has actually, I think, shown itself to have rather better instincts than Bastrykin had. Bastrykin had these very, very maximalist instincts, and in part because, for career reasons, he had to distinguish himself from the rest of the pack. And the way you do that is by being more extreme rather than being more liberal. The FSB, I mean, as I understand it, the FSB was, for example, really quite resistant is perhaps the wrong word, but shall I say concerned about the original Bolotnaya arrests. You have the interesting case that the FSB and the MVD, the Interior Ministry, both were really not convinced that this was a wise strategy. It was Bastrykin, the Investigations Committee, that really sort of pushed for those arrests.
And one has to wonder if... Go ahead.
I would say, and now we're precisely actually beginning to see a potential rollback of that decision.
And interestingly enough, in the court cases, a lot of the times, a couple of times this happened, where police officers actually appeared to be... They're technically prosecution witnesses, but they actually acted almost as if they were defense witnesses in the case. The Kosenko case is the obvious example there. But continue your thought there on the FSB.
I think you might say this is not just about an institutional conflict, though everything in Russian politics is about institutional politics and one group against another. But it's also, I think, going back to this business of, I hesitate to call it a philosophical, but let's say a sort of a tactical or strategic decision about how to handle dissent. The FSB has historically taken much more of a long view. It's not been about just simply sort of the personal ambitions of the director in a way that the Investigations Committee was entirely a Bastrykin vehicle. And a sense that it's always better. I mean, it's interesting, they still go back to, frankly, the Andropovian model, mm-hmm. which is that it's always better to predict and deter rather than actually have to prosecute after the event. And therefore, I think the FSB's model is one that I think we might see coming back into favor in the Kremlin. That rather than actually trying to deal with the opposition head on, you try and deal with those things that you can afford to deal with that actually generate opposition in the first place. It doesn't matter. I mean, Navalny, as an individual, is not important. He's important if he is able to tap into veins of discontent and disquiet, which suddenly give him a movement. Now, Bastrykin's model is you smash Navalny. The FSB's model is Navalny doesn't matter if he can't connect to disgruntled populations. Because after all, the smart secret policeman wants you to be happy. Obedient, but happy.
So the FSB's model, the FSB's methods are much more subtle and deft. Now, if we, and I tend to think you're right about that's where we might be headed, away from this investigative committee model and toward an FSB model. What do you think that's going to mean in practice with all these things out there, with Navalny, Bolotnaya, Pussy Riot, arrest of society, a regime that's been sort of on the defensive and having trouble finding its footing, debates within the elite about where to go? What is this, if the FSB comes back to the fore as the main heavies, the heavies with a velvet touch, which I never thought I'd use that adjective to describe the FSB, but in this case, I guess it applies. What does that mean in practice?
Well, I think it shifts, first of all, clearly does shift power within the elite to, shall I say, the Sobyanins rather than the Bastrykins.
So the FSB is the friend of the technocrats.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it seems strange, but I think that the point is that we have to realize that distinctions and divisions that made perfect sense under Putin won, where we were definitely talking about sort of Siloviks versus liberal technocrats, I think matter or mean much, much less nowadays. That actually many of the Siloviki have become much more technocratic and vain. And I think there is that growing sense that the issue is not about rebuilding the state as it was under Putin 1, which required, from their point of view, much more forcible measures to control, above all, the elite. Now the issue is preserving one, in which the elite is, with various divisions, but basically speaking, united that they want to keep the status quo. So it's really much more a case of, and again, I think this is a fascinating parallel with what we saw in late Soviet times, in which actually the KGB was the cradle of reformism.
Exactly, that's where Perestroika was born in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Now, I mean, I think they will have learned some of the lessons of Perestroika, but you might say they, I think, hearken back to the more Andropovian model of reform, the early Gorbachev model of reform, which basically was concentrating on, firstly, economics, actually ensuring that you have an economic system that works at least to a certain extent and can deal with the more sort of flagrant issues affecting people. But secondly, identifying those particular sort of points of vulnerability and for the regime and shoring them up so that you don't want to try and sort of bring in greater democratization or transparency or anything like that. You just simply want to have a more smoothly managed semi-authoritarian regime. So, I mean, I think that what we're going to see in terms of policy. And I think that is likely to actually sort of have all kinds of other potential knock-on. I mean, one of the key things is going to be like sort of the defense budget. Are they actually going to bite the bullet and begin to reduce that, as goes against Putin's grain, but would free up resources to be spent on things that really need the money spent on, like infrastructure, education, and social care. So I think we're not yet at the end of this policy discussion, but we're seeing a reopening of this policy discussion, the extent to which actually you can have thoroughly nasty and selfish conservatives, nonetheless feeling that they need to have some kind of more moderate reform process just simply to preserve what they've got.
And before we move on, we also have another player moving into this. The biggest climb down of all in all of these cases we've talked about, of course, is the Navalny case. And careful reading of the Russian press shows a lot of commentators say he does have support even within the security and law enforcement community. What does that mean in practice? Because that can get quite interesting, no?
Yeah, it certainly can. I mean, I suspect that a lot of the support for him is precisely because at the moment he represents the only alternative pole in politics. Yes, the communists have got their supporters and whatever else, but nonetheless, you know, if you are unhappy with the status quo, there is really only one direction you can turn. And in some ways, the very things that dismay us in the West about Navalny of late, particularly his stance on nationalism / racism, actually also make him in some ways a more plausible, more understandable, more recognizable, more sympathetic character to these sort of disgruntled or you know, elements within the police and security apparatus. So, I mean, I'm not sure if what we're talking about is a really strong active affinity for him. But on the other hand, I think it's more that this is just simply a reflection of a considerable sense of malaise within the law enforcement, security and military communities. A sense that actually they're not particularly comfortable, not very happy with the status quo, and therefore for the moment they will look to whoever is presenting an alternative. Mm. I mean, you mentioned Khodorkovsky. One of the interesting sort of and just random thoughts I was having, you know, every now and then there is talk of a potential amnesty. Who knows? I'm not certainly sure that I'd sort of advocate or expect it, but nonetheless, an interesting tactic would be precisely to release him, because then all of a sudden you would have two poles. And we know that Navalny is very much running a one-man band. The coordinating committee of the opposition is basically dead. The people around Navalny are clearly his aides and his supporters rather than his peers.
The collective Navalny is forming.
But how would he cope with the emergence of a potential, shall I say, elder statesman?
Mm-hmm.
Who has considerable credibility precisely with the more liberal wing of his own movement. Would he seek to contest the liberal wing, or would he instead actually simply rely much more on the sort of maximalist, disgruntled, with a bit of racism wing of his movement? I mean, it's one reason why Zhirinovsky seems to be ramping up his anti-Navalny rhetoric, because horrific though it is to be putting it in these terms, in some ways he is particularly vulnerable to Navalny. We could well see people defecting from the Liberal Democrats to Navalny.
Yeah,
and so there's all kinds of potential dynamics.
Well, and it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. In a few moments, we will shift gears and look at a terrorist attack in the city of Volgograd and its potential implications as the Sochi Olympics approach. I'd like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Сегодня днем в Волгограде произошел теракт. Взрывное устройство сработало в пассажирском автобусе.
Привела в действие смертница, гражданская жена одного из боевиков.
30-летняя жительница Махачкалы Наида Асиялова.
Наида Асиялова. Это жена Дмитрия Соколова.
Поиск смертницы для своей жены Асияловой. Установили следователи
конечные точки маршрута. In the southern city of Volgograd this week, an explosion on a passenger bus killed 6 people and injured at least 33 more, some seriously. Officials say the blast was caused by a suicide bomber, who police identify as 30-year-old Naida Asialova, a native of Dagestan. Coming just months before the 2014 Olympics are scheduled to begin, the incident has, of course, raised concerns about security at the Games.
It was clear that this was a test run ahead of the Sochi Olympics. It's clear that international terrorist groups, or groups affiliated with them, want to create an atmosphere of fear and panic ahead of the start of the Olympics.
Well, that's one interpretation. But this being Russia, there are, of course, were suspicions that something else might be afoot. When the authorities said they found Asialova's passport at the scene of the blast, they showed it on state television. And after this, the speculation lit up on social media. What kind of suicide bomber carries their passport on a mission? How is it recovered intact? Female suicide bombers always take passports with them when they go on a mission and themselves turn into a bloody mess, manage to keep the documents perfectly intact, one blogger sarcastically wrote. Some suggested a link with recent nationalist riots in southern Moscow, others with an FSB plan to implement greater surveillance of the internet. And all of this gets to the heart of a very real problem in Russia. The country does indeed face a very real threat from very real terrorists. But when an attack comes, people are so skeptical of the regime that they are also skeptical of the official version of events. A dress rehearsal for Sochi, a symptom of North Caucasus restiveness, and an FSB plot. Mark, you're the security expert. What do you make of all of this?
Well, if you'll forgive me if I sort of dump a whole bunch of thoughts, and by all means, just stop me whenever you want or whatever. First of all, let me just deal briefly with the passport issue. Of course she would carry her passport. Bear in mind that especially if you're covering your head, you are at any point prone to have to present your documents, especially if you're actually getting a ticket for a long-distance bus journey. Not to have carried her documents would have meant that she probably had been stopped at the first such potential check. So actually, one would expect her to be carrying her documents. Could they have been intact? Well, yeah. Bombs are funny things. They tend to impart sort of energy rather than immediately sort of disintegrate everything in their path. It's by no means surprising for stuff to be essentially intact. The problem we've had is particularly that there's been these sort of once they showed this entirely pristine passport, and then yeah. a thoroughly damaged one with a different photo. We can come on to that because I think it speaks very much to that issue of trust and legitimacy. An FSB sort of plot, and again, you know, these things always come up with reason, considering the apartment bombings. But I don't see that as being the case. If nothing else,
no, neither do I. To be clear, neither do I. But it's sure. It's out there. It's out there.
Again, I mean, I think again, the FSB currently is getting everything it wants anyway. You know, it's getting these new powers to monitor the internet and so forth. Regardless, again, the fact that people are saying this, it says something about how they feel about the authorities rather than anything else. And likewise, the idea that there's some link to Sochi is thoroughly dubious. A suicide bomber is a rare and delicate terrorist resource. You spend a lot of time building them up to the pitch at which they're willing to do so. And once they are at that pitch, you can't. They're not like the other forms of munition that you can just put on the shelf in the armory until it's needed. You really have a relatively limited length of time before, basically, they lose that willingness. It's not normal for human beings to become suicide killers. So essentially, we tend to find that suicide bombers are used when they have been cultivated to the point that they can be used. So instead, well, what does this mean? Honestly, this is one of those things. Try as we might to find some big picture rationale, the honest answer is Russia has embroiled itself in a particularly nasty insurgent/terrorist/guerrilla campaign in the North Caucasus. You know, particularly we see that there's a strong Dagestani link with the suicide bombers that we've seen. There will continue to be plots, there will continue to be attacks and such like, many of which will never actually manifest, will never make the news, particularly, I mean, let's face it, inside the North Caucasus, attacks are near enough daily occurrence. Very rarely do they sort of get out into the more.
This was the first This was the first one outside the North Caucasus in years, though, which is one of the reasons why.
Well, exactly, but this is, I mean, Volgograd, which is sort of fairly close or whatever, there will be these attacks. True resilience, after all, comes from being aware that no security is guaranteed, that in fact maladjusted people driven by malign groomers will continue to launch attacks. And I said I find it hard to see any great rationale beyond that. The big picture issue is exactly what you raised. It's the fact that most people.
Not
no,
most,
I think it's fair to say most. Well, actually, I think
a lot of people.
I'm willing to believe. I mean, if one looks at the opinion polls, I think most people mistrust the state. they might actually sort of have approval ratings for Putin or whatever. But when you look at kind of core issues, you know, do you believe that there is corruption in the top echelons of the government, etc.? I mean, actually, we tend to find that more than 50% mm-hmm. will express views that clearly make it feel that they don't essentially trust the state as a whole. This has always actually, ironically, been one of Putin's strengths, is that the people have seen him as the tool that can restrain mm-hmm. this corrupt and evil sort of elite. But in that respect, okay, most whatever, but you know, there is a large portion of people who almost instinctively assume that they're being told lies. And again, this is a fascinating and worrying throwback to what we saw in late Soviet times. Mm-hmm.
We keep having those throwbacks, huh?
Yeah, in which actually, essentially, what you saw in Pravda or Izvestia or whatever, you would flip 180 degrees and assume that was the case. You know, we're not quite there yet, but nonetheless, I think this is an interesting little sort of particular way of looking at what I can only really describe as the delegitimation of the current regime.
And now with Sochi, I mean, going into Sochi, there are legitimate security concerns, nevertheless, whether or not this is connected to Sochi or not. And I think I tend to agree with you, it's probably not. But going into Sochi, there are legitimate security concerns there, aren't there?
Absolutely. I mean, there's the fact that the rebel movement has been instructed to do everything it can to disrupt the satanic games, as Dr. Umarov put it. There are Circassian and Adige nationalist concerns about the fact that some of the sites are built on their sort of holy territory, sort of linked to past pogroms. Definitely there is a real threat to that, which is one reason why the Russians are devoting such a phenomenal amount of resources into securing it. Thousands of police, thousands of troops, these draconian laws, a security zone in which actually some people are going to be forced to relocate out for the duration of the games, in which private cars will basically need to have permits, all these sorts of things, because they precisely don't want to have some embarrassment. Of course, it doesn't matter how much money and how many resources you throw into an operation, there's always a chance of something getting through. We've seen in the past that corruption and human error are not exactly unknown to the Russian security apparatus, after all.
How, from somebody who looks at the security services pretty closely, I mean, how capable are they of, when they really need to, not just want to, but really need to, how good are they at counterterrorism, really?
They're not bad. I think the point is that their strength is always, shall we say, the brute force approach in every sense of the word. Yes, it means sometimes that the heavy-handed method. It was quite fascinating, actually. An FSB spokesman was sort of claiming that Sochi will not be like a concentration camp, which is how he described the security measures in London during the London Olympics, but instead the security measures would be invisible. Well, that's absolute nonsense. There's going to be people all over the place, document checks, metal detectors, you name it. So, you know, one of their strengths is violence, but the other strength is precisely throwing lots of people and lots of resources and really trying to provide security by rote, which, you know, is effective. The problem is, for me, is that it also tends to be coupled with a lack of imagination. If one looks, for example, at the exercises that they've been running, you know, they clearly have a fairly narrow palette of threats that they think they need to resist against. They think they need to resist against the potential ability, you know, risk of a Mumbai-style swarming attack where a bunch of people with guns just start sort of shooting people in general, or an attempt to actually infiltrate a sort of an armed group, whether by sea or by land, or individual sort of, you know, suicide bombers, which are clearly the sort of the main potential risks. And they've also got, you know, planes and missiles in case of something sort of 9/11-ish. But what strikes me is that terrorism and counterterrorism are, as much as anything else, imagination races. That, you know, smart terrorists will be aware of the security methods concerned. You know, the Russians are deploying 25,000 police, 8,000 interior troops, and they'll have 20 to 30,000 soldiers either at Sochi or close by, ready on call. This is all a matter of record. So it's unlikely that Chechens, Adygay, Kabardino, Balkarians, whatever group, is actually going to just try and challenge them directly. So they'll be trying to think of ways around it, whether it's, for example, using laborers, all the many laborers who've been working on this, to forward secrete weapons or explosives in the area, and then just have people coming in. They might well be looking to, I mean, we've seen this as a growing issue, is ethnic Russian converts to jihadist Islam.
The husband of the suicide bomber in Volgograd, for example, who is still at large.
Yeah, exactly. People who are so-called greenskins, who don't yet have, you know, haven't yet been identified as potential radicals, they haven't got arrests or whatever. One of these just simply buys a ticket and goes, or gets a job as one of the 25,000 volunteers. You know, all these. There are all these other ways in which you can. You know, it's not just going to be
the obvious.
Men with big beards trying to drive a truck full of guns in there. But that's the final point: is that, you know, it doesn't matter how good your procedures are, it doesn't matter how good or how many officers you've got. If we think back to how it was possible to basically drive all the way through all kinds of security checkpoints, you know, in the past, precisely just simply by bluffing and bribing your way past. Mm-hmm. We've seen Chechens being able to do that already. So my big concern is not, as it were, the plans. Russians are very good at planning. It's not at the level of resources. They're devoting a, you know, ridiculous level of resources. They're spending $2 billion on security, which is twice as much as on the 2010 Vancouver Winter Olympics. It's that exactly it's going to be those human errors of people just not thinking of a particular sort of out-of-the-box threat, or people taking bribes, turning a blind eye, or whatever. That, for me, is the real danger.
And there's one other thing I'd also want to bring in before we wrap it up for today, and that's that Russia can't really do this alone. And they're going to have the assistance from in one particular neighbor that I'm thinking of. Months ago, I interviewed the Georgian defense minister, Irakli Alasani, and one of the things he wanted to make a point of to me saying is, like, we are ready and we're starting to make moves towards doing everything possible to make sure the Sochi games are safe. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to do whatever we can do from the Georgian side. Now, are the Russian security services ready, willing, and able to work with the Georgian security? Because really, Georgia's right next door there.
No, I think
because anything that comes in could come through Georgia. I mean, anything that comes in could come in very well through Georgia.
Yeah, the thing is that really, I think it would be very useful for the Russians to be cooperating with the Georgians. And I'm sure that the Georgians genuinely would want to help.
No, Alasani was sincere, and I know him, and he was sincere.
I don't question that. I think the trouble is, I think the Russians still see this as being a sort of an issue that really is about securing the border. Now, okay, we see a different government in Georgia that is much more kind of Russia friendly, but I'm not really getting the sense, certainly, that the Russian security apparatus, which after all, you know, has already claimed to have foiled one Georgian attempt to arm terrorists. A very, very dubious.
Well, and this is precisely why Mr. Alasani said, I don't want anything happening there because I don't want it to happen, but also because there's a good chance that we could get blamed, right?
Yeah, exactly. But instead, I mean, what's happening? I mean, if you look at the recent, quite recently, 2012 exercises, Sochi 2012 was actually sort of a military exercise that they had. They had about 6,000 personnel deployed. And one of the key things was precisely, it was actually support for the border guards in defending the Georgian border. They're still seeing this as something that means actually stopping things at the border rather than, as it were, stopping things on the other side of the border working with the Georgians. There's all kind of cooperation going on, even despite the various sort of spy allegations and so forth, and indeed the Snowden case, with Western and other intelligence communities. Not particularly two-way, to be honest. I mean, the Russian notion of cooperation is very much just give us your files and your data and tell us what we need to know. But nonetheless, it's happening, and precisely because no one wants to see their nationals, their sportsmen, their tourists and so forth being targeted, people are willing to work with the Russians on this. So actually, there is a lot of cooperation going on, but Georgia remains something of a blind spot. And I think, as I said, I get the sense that it's the Russian security apparatus that is very, very resistant to working with the Georgians. As you say, the Georgians have every reason, practical as much as anything else, to be wanting to be seen as good citizens and to ensure that nothing happens on their mutual and rather sensitive border. I just don't know if the Russians are really willing to work with them.
That's a very worrying sign. And on that note, we'll wrap it up for now. That's all, folks, at least for today. I would like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been co-host Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Mark, it's been great to have you back.
It's been too long.
It certainly has. And I'd also like to thank our producer, Pavel Balak, for ably filling in for Tanya Konchova, who is enjoying a much-needed break from me. I'd also like to thank my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noize MC. We'll be right back.